Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Anna Mae Donaldson of Guelph Politico. If this is your first time streaming or downloading the program, Guelph Politicast is an interview show where I talk to politicians, activists, and people of note making a difference or just trying to make life in Norrell City more interesting. For previous episodes of the Guelph Politicast, you can find them on the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or you can subscribe through iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Today I talk to Noor Al-Adib, the chairperson, president of the Canadian Federation of Students Ontario. With the provincial election, I thought it might be fun and interesting to dedicate the next several episodes of the show to issues around the provincial election, which officially gets underway today if you're listening to this on Wednesday. Now, this won't be about party platforms, but instead focus on the issues themselves, in detail, and from the people actually working on them every day. This week, we'll start with post-secondary students. The perspective of our local university and college students is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. Now, first things first, our post-secondary students are not a homogenous mass that's merely concerned about their tuition fees. In fact, you may be surprised to learn that the concerns of young people in university and college in Ontario reflect those of the vast cross-section of other Ontario voters on issues like healthcare, childcare, jobs, housing, transit, and yes, tuition fees and quality education. There's also social justice issues, reconciliation, divestment, and climate change. They're also high on the priority list, but you can hardly say that only young people are concerned about those issues either. In other words, students are just like us. One of the main political wings of student organization is the Canadian Federation of Students, which, as the name implies, is pan-Canadian but is also separated into provincial jurisdictions. The CFS Ontario is by far the biggest, representing over 350,000 full and part-time students in the province by partnering with 35 local student unions to form a coalition of advocacy on behalf of Ontario's post-secondary students, whether that's academic, like their Fight the Fees campaign, social, like their campaign against gender-based violence, or the practical, like administering the International Student Identity Card, which offers discounts to student card holders. Since the administration and funding of post-secondary education is under provincial jurisdiction, this is the chance for CFS to have the hardest impact. Of course, this is also the time of year when most students are not in school but are traveling or working summer jobs, taking part in internships, or just enjoying a well-earned break from school. The CFS, though, is still going to do everything they can to make sure students' concerns stay front and center and that Ontario's post-secondary students get out and vote because, as proven with the 2015 federal election, the voices of young people can be powerful when they speak at the ballot box. So this week on the Guelph Politicast, we talked to Noor Al-Adib about the CFS campaign, why students are more than one-issue voters, and some of the challenges that post-secondary students in Ontario face. Along with that, we cover a wide range of issues, including the need for affordable housing geared to students, the growing need for regional transit as more students are commuting to school, and what can be done about the growing mental health needs of students. We also touch on the job action on several campuses this past year and the effects on students, and most importantly, the effect of those ever-increasing tuition fees. Not that this isn't the be-all and end-all of a student voter, of course. So I caught up with Noor Al-Adib last week by phone. So Noor Al-Adib, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So to begin with, can you talk a little about CFS and what it is you do with CFS?
Yeah, definitely. So the Canadian Federation of Students is one of the oldest and largest organizations in Canada that represents students in post-secondary education. We have provincial components, so I'm the chairperson of the Ontario component, and I have the privilege of representing over 350,000 students in the province. Those students are full-time students, part-time students, students in graduate and undergraduate programs. They're such a diverse bunch of students that I absolutely love and adore. And pretty much like what we do is work on improving the student experience in post-secondary education and fight for free and accessible post-secondary education for all. So yeah, I guess that's it in a nutshell.
In so much as these things can be crunched into a nutshell, because you mentioned diversity, I think that one of the things that certainly me approaching this was thinking about what students are concerned about the election, probably primarily educational issues, the things to do with their schooling. Mm-hmm. But you referred me to a website the CFS has set up on issues, and
it's a lot.
it just struck me. That was my immediate thought. It's like, you know, I've been a student. I've been a student a while, but
yeah.
I guess I've gotten into that blind spot of mm-hmm. not recognizing that students are people who have a wide yeah. range of concerns on a litany of different issues and not just yeah. their education.
Exactly. Like, we're not one-dimensional. We come from all different walks of life, and at the end of the day, even when we graduate, these issues don't just, like, fall off the face of the earth. There's something like that we continue to face even after we graduate. So I think it's good to be talking about the ways that they're all interconnected and the ways that we can improve them from now. That way, even when we go throughout our post-secondary education, higher education, or even when we graduate and move on into, like, the workforce, these are issues that we're going to need to work on. So I love it. I love this campaign so much.
Having said that, though, you know, these do, you know, affect students. Mm-hmm. Things like the minimum wage increase.
Yeah.
And one of the statistics that struck me was that students must work 21 full-time weeks in order to pay for their tuition versus, I think, 25 years ago, it was 9 weeks.
Yeah. It's rough. And I think, like, the reasons for that is considering that our tuition fees increase by 3-5% mm-hmm. if you're a domestic student, 3% if you're, like, in an arts and science program, and 5% in professional faculties. If you're an international student, they're unregulated, so they can increase by any percentage. But when we notice the ways that minimum wage has increased over time, our tuition fees have actually increased so much faster that we're not able to keep up with just working a minimum wage job or just one over the summer.
Right.
So that's really, in my opinion, the reason why.
Yeah, it was tough for me because I was at school during the Mike Harris days.
Oh, fun.
That sums it up. But, you know, I was the tuition rates were such that, you know, working a summer would get me at least one full semester funding that I wouldn't have to lean on OSAP on.
Yeah.
But even at that, when we're talking about 21 weeks to save for your tuition, that doesn't count, you know, food, that doesn't count lodging,
right.
That doesn't count your textbooks, because despite the paperless age, students still need their textbooks.
Yeah, and even with paperless, folks can still charge us to access things online, you know? So it's not limited to just that, yeah.
That's right. I did want to ask you about regional transit, too, because from what I understand, one of the things you talked about on your on this website, the CFS talks about, is the need for more sort of on-campus housing. But one of the things that I know the U of G here is talking about is that a lot of people aren't looking for on-campus housing, and that because of the cost of housing, you're getting a lot more commuters. And I think this is where regional transit comes into play, because a lot of people are seeing the financial benefit of staying at home and, you know, doing the commuting. And regional transit doesn't reach everyone equally.
Not at all. And, that's really on a provincial scope, what's interesting is that, like, when we're talking about transit access out of the Greater Toronto Hamilton area, even though there's unique difficulties there, it's actually more difficult for students outside of that area.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about students in Northern Ontario, they actually can't afford to take transit because of how long it takes to get to campus. For them, it's actually easier to pay for a car and a parking pass. And I imagine that may be a similar sentiment for students at the University of Guelph, or they compromise by not paying for, you know, a car and gas and insurance and things like that. So they opt for, you know, the GO or regional transportation, but that means it's coming at the cost of time that they could spend getting involved on campus, time that they could spend working, time that they can spend studying to improve their grades and things like that. So when we're talking to the provincial government about transit, it's also acknowledging that, you know, the municipalities have agency over their own transit authorities, and how can we create a system where the provincial government is supporting these municipalities to ensure that they have the infrastructure and the fare. Like, I know at the University of Guelph, you folks have a transit pass. Not everywhere has that.
Yep.
And I absolutely adore the U-Pass. But what does it look like to maybe create a provincial U-Pass where all students can have that mobility to travel anywhere with that one pass, but also have the infrastructure to do that and feel like it's a viable option? So I hear that. And acknowledging that transit isn't good enough, then what can we do on the housing front to ensure that students have adequate housing and that they're not cooped up with five other individuals in really small rooms to offset the cost of commuting. So it seems like we always get the short end of the stick, but I'm optimistic. So, yeah.
And regional transit, though, if I can harp on that for a sec, is I do creating something like a U-Pass that's provincially. I mean, we're kind of halfway there when you're thinking about the Presto card and what Metrolinx is doing and coordinating with TTC and Viva and other transit services. But, you know, even you mentioned students who live further up north. I've heard people here on campus at the U of G talk about how, you know, they can't go home for a weekend because it takes 21 hours just to get up the road in the province. But even for students coming to Guelph from Hamilton, you know, there's no direct bus there either. And Hamilton's, you know, a half hour to hour drive down the road. It's there are huge gaps. And even in GTHA, where we think we're, you know, by comparison to other places in the province, we're actually quite quite well set, but there are still huge gaps.
100%.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I still find it weird that Metrolinx is a crown corporation. It's a provincial, you know, like the provincial government oversees it, but it's still so limited. Like, the entire province is not the Greater Toronto Hamilton area.
Right.
I think that's sort of offensive to everybody else. So I think in order for us to, like, adequately support the needs of people across the province when it comes to transit, we need to really see, like, what supports that Metrolinx can support, like, provide in order to create, like, to satisfy those needs.
Mm-hmm. And this is something where, you know, coordinating across, you know, vast distances, that would be something the province would be ideally set up to do. So, I mean, that's an important point that, you know, Metrolinx is still a very much GTA organization, not so much a provincial organization, even though their bosses in Queen's Park are provincially.
Yeah.
To go back to the housing, I feel like there's some confusion about this, and this is what I've seen in my city council, is that there's a difference between how people afford or define affordable housing, and I think our city definition that our city staff use is very much like market based but a little bit cheaper, so that if you're someone who does have, you know, a decent salary under their definition of affordable housing, that means you. But it is very tricky for students because, limited means for many students. But at the same time, I feel like there are many students who feel like they're quite powerless in terms of their housing options. And at the same time, there are a lot of places in my neck of the woods, Guelph and KW, where people see students as the enemy and maybe get what they pay for, too.
Yeah, and I think that, like, that's not something unique, unfortunately. There's often an antagonism to the millennial, in essence, where it's like, you should be able to do this. Don't spend your money on avocado toast. You should be more responsible with your money. But
that's,
I think,
right,
when we look at the statistics, they're like, it does tie back to, say, like, the minimum wage and acknowledging where that portion of our money is going to. It's going to pay off tuition, even if we have access to, you know, OSAP, that, like, where are students able to find the money to support themselves to be able to go rent, not even having the dream of being able to buy a place, because that's just out of the question.
Right.
So I definitely understand that, like, there is that, and I guess I would say it's very antagonistic to say that, like, students are the enemy and they can't do things themselves or be responsible with their money. But I think that we have to be, and I think that's where that equity-based, in my opinion, like, we have to take things through different lenses and say that something that's deemed affordable for, you know, a family with folks, two individuals who are working full-time and supporting a family, is very different than what it looks like to be a student in post-secondary education trying to pay through your tuition fees and things like that.
Yeah.
The definitions of affordability change depending on what your reality is. So I think that if we could push for changes in those definitions, I think that would be really important. It's really about supporting the people who need it most. It's not just students in post-secondary education who are struggling for housing. We have a housing crisis in Ontario and in British Columbia, and those are conversations that provincially and nationally we need to have to be able to address and then come with solutions that are unique and dynamic to each type of demographic. So those are some of the things that we're working on with our coalition partners on a provincial and federal level.
Mm-hmm.
So I hear you on that. Sorry.
It is tricky because you either get places that are, you know, the developers who are building things that aren't going to be geared towards people who don't have the means, or people have limited means, or that includes students, or you have developments that are building things geared towards students and are facing an uphill climb, there was a development in Waterloo a couple of years ago where they said, oh, you're going to be able to move in on September the 1st, and then it was several months later and the building still wasn't finished, and some people were living in half-completed suites.
Yeah, and still expected to pay the same amount, like the cost and things like that. It's not really a great return on your investment.
No. In terms of, we've talked about tuition a lot. I don't want to kind of talk about political parties or platforms or anything, but, you know, we have had the same party in power for the better part of two decades, and they've made kind of a big deal of saying that they've, you know, helped, you know, lower tuition fees and helped for students of limited means, and helped initiate free tuition. But and correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, I know student organizers like yourself are saying, you know, there's kind of two ways to see this, that, you know, there's the glass half full way, which coming from the government, but there's also the glass half empty, in that we still have thousands of students who are graduating every year with, you know, crippling debt.
Yeah, 100%. And, like, I think that wording is really important. The way that you define something is crucial, which is sort of like what we just discussed. But there's no one has implemented free tuition.
Yeah.
Tuition still increases by 3 to 5%. When we came to time to negotiate that that legislation that mandates that, it was sort of kicked down, like they sort of kicked down the can to sort of deal with it later. Mm. So they rolled that policy over for 2 more years. So we'll come up with a new, like, whoever gets elected will have to deal with that situation. But what had happened was that folks had change the way that grant systems operate. Now, the free tuition, quote unquote, is just an amalgamation of grants that had already existed.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually one of the recommendations of the Federation. We had gone and seen all of these grants that had existed, but found inefficiencies in them and recommended changes to ensure that more students were able to access them, because they were very niche before.
Right.
When we're talking about, like, who's in power and the ways that tuition and grants have changed over, I guess, like, let's say 20 years, I wouldn't say that any party has done an amazing job at that. No, but we're seeing some really great changes that I think are helpful to say that it is possible to create a free and accessible post-secondary education. We just have to prioritize it. We have to want to make it happen. And I think that in the past few years with the Liberal government, we've been able to push and make those changes happen. But I guarantee you that no matter who is elected, we're not going to settle for less than what students deserve. And that's a truly free and accessible post-secondary education, one where you're not paying back loans later, one where you're not having to top off, you know, your ancillary fees because the grant has only covered your tuition. One where we're not talking about how much tuition fees are going to be increasing per year, but really talking about what types of investments are the government making in order to take off that upfront payment. So I guess that's where we're sitting with tuition fees. Like, I'm really happy to see the changes, but I know that there's still a lot of students being left behind. When you think about the numbers, around a third of students have benefited from this program, which is amazing, but we have close to 1 million students in Ontario. So what does that mean for the other two-thirds? That's not to assume that they can afford it. That's not to assume that, like, they don't want to apply for it.
Right.
That means that we're still missing people.
And there's still gaps in terms of who can get access to those benefits. And, you know, if you're somebody who is out on your own, but you have parents who have means, the OSAP will still say to you, well, can't you go and talk to your parents versus saying, you know.
Yeah. And, like, thankfully we've been able to make some of the changes, like some of the changes that we've recommended to the OSAP application will be rolling out in September this year. For example, like a lower parental, depending less on parental and spousal income, because we can't assume that if your family makes enough money that you're able to access that. Like there are dynamics and it's just not like that across the board. But another one that we're still pushing for is for part-time students. There's an assumption that part-time students are working and therefore can afford it, but students go part-time for a number of different issues or reasons. Like, I'm a part-time student because I work full-time and I can't be there, but I still don't make enough to be able to support my tuition fees, right?
Right.
Because of, like, where the job market is at. So why make those assumptions about students and how they're able to access post-secondary education when they're telling us what they need? We need to be able to move forward and make those priorities, like, you know, reflected in our budgets provincially. So
yeah, you live in the unique paradox where you are a student leader and you are paid to be a student leader, but that's a full-time job, so you can't go to school full-time, which is one of the
it's like really weird. And I had to move to Toronto, and Toronto costs an arm and a leg to live here.
Yeah.
And it's a lot, but I'm getting by. Yeah,
well, getting by is okay.
Yes. But like, I think that's what's painful is that I'm very grateful to be in the position that I'm at and be able to get by, but sometimes that's not enough, and I know that it's possible to not settle for the bare minimum.
Right.
So how do we move forward to a society where the bare minimum isn't enough?
Mm-hmm.
That way everybody can live comfortably, and we know the benefits of you know, properly resource public services, and education is a public service. We all benefit from it. So why not create that investment? I study economics, so it's like really helpful to apply those, because oftentimes like what happens is people scare students into thinking that your priorities will make the economy crash. And that's very much the opposite. When you study economics, you can actually see that no, these investments have a great return, and we need to prioritize those. So
And that could be said for any number of areas, be that the minimum wage. And, you know, there are a lot of scare tactics about the minimum wage increase.
Yeah.
And the research shows that it's just not the case. The economy does not tank when the minimum wage goes up.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked a lot about how there's no such thing as the average student. But I am wondering, in the great big Venn diagram that is student life across Ontario, what are the things that you think the quote unquote average student is worried about? Like, what are their priorities?
I think like it depends on the individual student. Like, sorry, not the individual student, but where the student is at. So, for example, like students in full time studies, undergraduate or graduate, will still have very unique realities, because like for our graduate students, it's talking about like, how do I fund my research without depending on corporations who will tell me what type of result they want my research to say, because it benefits their work. And if I don't give them that result, they'll withdraw my funding. Or for, you know, undergraduate full-time students, it could look like I'm working two part-time jobs and I have an exam next week, but I don't want to, you know, ask my supervisor for time off to study because they might not schedule me for shifts next week,
right?
Like it's all of these different things. For part-time students, it's like, what does it look like for me to maybe be taking care of my family or make rent on time and still be able to pay my textbook course, my classes, or even being in class when you're scheduled for a shift. Like if I have a class where my participation is 20%, but I can't physically be in class because I have to work, like, what does it look like for me to tell my professor that I can't physically be there and hopefully my grades won't suffer because of that? So it's really, really, really complex. And when we're talking about, like, even, you know, our Indigenous students who federally have a cap of 2% on funding through the PSSSP program, but our tuition is increasing by 3% to 5%. Like, they have been set up to fail, literally set up to fail. And now with, like, I don't think this has ever disappeared. It's always existed. But different types of students go on campus and have different experiences because of their race, their gender expression. And we're seeing these issues being talked about more, of racism, of transphobia, of homophobia, of Islamophobia. And there's so many, like, there's so many things that impact the everyday student experience that I guess it would be really difficult to pinpoint a few, but I do think it's about survival, and it's about getting through the program to hopefully get into a job market that you'll be able to continue to live a comfortable life.
Right.
I think that's where our students are at. And I can tell that's the case because even when we're hosting events or anything like that to get students out, it's very difficult because our students are running from one thing to the next and they want to be engaged, but they can't.
Yeah.
So I think it's like right now students are at a means of survival and they just want to see parties and individuals who are going to prioritize their lives.
Yeah, it's funny to think of political engagement as a point of privilege.
It is, yeah.
But it is very much. This does lead into something else I did want to ask about, which is mental health.
Yeah.
I feel like we're getting a lot of lip service about mental health, and I think all the party platforms, again, not to get into party platforms, but they all do address it in some way. But yeah. I feel like this... there's something about the mental health of young people and students in particular that I think is getting lost in the shuffle, because we've had a number of campuses, and Guelph is included in that, that have had problems with clusters of young people taking their lives. And I don't think I've yet to hear anyone address that. At least I've seen the reactions in terms of, you know, you have campus doing campus community doing outreach and knocking on doors, making sure everyone's okay at exam times and things like that. But in terms of identifying the causes and attacking the causes, I don't think we've had a holistic discussion about that.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, like, unfortunately, our institutions are very old institutions with new responsibilities.
Mm.
And one of those new responsibilities are addressing, you know, where students are on the spectrum of mental well-being. And it's not just for students who have now come into post-secondary education and are now dealing with, you know, various mental health adversities, but it's also students who have had those prior to going into post-secondary education and walking in with those realities and carrying them through post-secondary education. But what it looks like are long wait times in you know, the health and counseling centers, or not having enough staff on site to support students, or just not creating a lifestyle of taking care of your well-being. And this is consistent across the board where, like, students want that 4.0. I need that 4.0. I need a good grade so I can go and find a job. I need a good grade so I can do this. And it hasn't at all prioritized the experience and taking care of yourself through that process.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I agree that a lot of the responses across the board have been really reactionary. And we're thinking of ways that we could be proactive in that. And some of the things that the Federation has been advocating for is similar to when we had created a whole section in the Ministry of Advanced Education and Skills Development to focus on sexual violence and harassment. We're actually advocating for a section in MASD as well to focus on mental well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And that could look like from, you know, services on and off campus to changing the lifestyle of students in post-secondary education. But that really does tie back to what the root of the problem is, and that is tuition fees.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember when the provincial budget came out and folks were, like, celebrating the new investments, like, we were thrilled, but it's not nipping it in the bud. These are going to continue. We're really giving Band-Aid solutions to consequences of different problems. So I think that there's a lot to do with mental health, and I'm not really interested in people giving me buzzwords and saying that they care about it. Like, there has to be a diverse way that we, you know, when we talk about mental health, because it also looks like different things for different communities. I'm a Middle Eastern, like, I'm from Syria. I was never raised on, like, taking medications and things like that. I was raised through a different lens of taking care of your mental well-being.
Right.
But even if that's the approach people want to take, that's okay. And how do we destigmatize, you know, the healthcare system and mental well-being and the things around that? So it's a very, very multifaceted problem that I don't think is going to be solved with just throwing money in different places. It has to be a very well thought out plan.
The number that's on the CFS site, that 65% of students say they feel anxiety.
Yeah.
I think and people have, I think, an understanding about what anxiety is, but, you know, mm-hmm. in terms of student life, what does that mean?
It could, I'm going to speak specifically about what it looks like
sure.
in the classroom.
Okay.
It looks like having a supervisor that is very, that can be very abusive.
Mm.
It can, and I'm talking specifically about like graduate students,
mm-hmm.
or the anxiety of having to finish your degree on time because you can't continue to fund post-secondary education mm-hmm. in the way that you have been.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like having, you know, 5 assignments due all on the same day, but you're in one program and your professors all know that you're in the same program and you all have that same midterm. It looks like not wanting to ask your supervisor at work for time off to study, because mm-hmm. they may not schedule you in for future shifts. And then that causes like a whole array of different, you know, problems.
Mm-hmm.
It can look like, you know, a student wanting to change something through their office of the registrar and getting the runaround and then being sent to their department and then back to the registrar and then the dean's office and things like that. Like, it's a lot of different things that are contributing to students' anxiety and depression.
Mm. And any one of those things can cause anxiety, but sometimes yeah. you're dealing with two or three or four or five of those things.
Yeah, and let's talk about our international students who are moving from where they're comfortable with their families and things like that, and their friends, and a place that they know well, to a place where they don't know the campus very well or the city, like where they're living very well. And where do they find those healthcare resources? Where do they find those student support services
mm-hmm.
to get good grades in order to stay, you know, a full-time student so you can continue to stay here on your study permit?
Mm-hmm.
And if not, if you don't do well in class, you get knocked down and potentially your permit expires and you get sent back home.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are so many things that contribute to the anxiety that students face. That, like, just talking about it right now makes me very, like, very upset.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It should be concerning that, you know, you were talking about 7, if we're rounding up, 7 out of every 10 students on campus. And, you know, you're talking about maybe some campus have, you know, 15, 20,000 students who, you know, it's 7 out of 10 of those students are feeling anxious about something. And, yeah. It's...
And like our students and student unions on campus are working really hard to find, you know, academic policies and supports that they can create to better support students on campus when situations like this happen. Like, for example, McMaster and the University of Toronto Mississauga Students Union, like they were working on policies that give students the ability to, like, if something happens, you don't have to create documentation and like to support your claim that you need an extension for 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
Because even asking for an extension from your professor can be sometimes, you know, nerve wracking. And unfortunately for our professors, like, that's another side that we don't talk about. The college strikes and the university strikes that have been happening are also a consequence of a system that's not working. Like,
mm-hmm.
our professors are running between different institutions in order to have multiple jobs in order to pay their own, like, you know, fulfill their own needs in life, that it looks like our professors not being able to stay after class to answer questions
right.
or to answer emails and things like that. So everything is so intertwined and interconnected, and it's like a domino effect. Everything creates like a really unhealthy environment in post-secondary education.
Yeah, there's definite stressors on the professors and the instructors as well, and not the least of which was job security, which is what the college
mm-hmm.
Lockout was all about last fall, which, you know, there's still lingering effects of students still struggling to get refunds and deal with that interruption.
And now York.
Yeah.
And Carleton, and it's never ending, it seems.
Do you think that will have an effect on not necessarily with the student vote, but do you think that voters in general are seeing the employment strife on campus and are taking that into consideration for their vote?
Yeah, and I don't think it's because, like, I think it has to do with people seeing the connections between, like, what it's like in the post-secondary sector and what it's like in other labor sectors.
Mm.
People have been talking about these issues for a very long time. And I think now people are starting to see that it's not just one sector Everybody is affected by it, which means that there's a larger problem that needs to be addressed.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll wrap up by, you know, speaking to you as yourself, not necessarily as you representing a student body, but as an engaged person, as someone who's steeped in these student issues, going into the election, you know, what are you listening for? What are your considerations, you know, that when you want to hear candidates speak on not just in educational issues, but, you know, in general, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I'm most interested in seeing people and how genuine they are. I think now that, like, I've learned so much about the different levels of government and things like that, I'm really interested to see, like, what the individual MPPs who are looking to, like, sorry, the individual candidates who are looking to run for these seats, where they're at and what they want to accomplish. Because I think that, like, obviously, how your party is impacts the way that you run and things like, and the priorities that you'll focus on. But I'm interested to see, like, where individual people are at across the province. In ways that we could create, like, relationships with these people to not make it a party issue, to make it an issue that's, like, for all the parties need to care about. For me, it's also about, like, where do they lie on the issues that, like, the Fairness for Students campaign is talking about. Because, like, when I was thinking about when we were creating this campaign, those were the issues that I was thinking about, because those are all issues that impact me, right? I think I'm also hoping that students will exercise the right to vote, and I'm thinking about, like, what does that look like for me on June 7th or in advanced stations when I'm working and I have summer school to go out and vote? Like, sometimes it's just logistical things about, like, how am I going to be an engaged person in society besides the fact that I'm the chairperson of the CFS Ontario, right? For me personally, I guess I'm, like, most excited about transit issues, about housing, because Toronto is so expensive, and workers' rights, because I know that I'm going to graduate next year, my term will finish next year, and I'm really scared to go out into the job market. So there's a lot of, like, things that I'm personally excited about for this election, but I'm also, it's sort of like the stars are aligning, because we have the provincial election, and then we have the municipal elections, and then we have the federal elections. So I'm not only thinking about the election in June, I'm thinking long-term about, like, okay, what? How am I going to continue to be engaged even past this, and how can I continue to keep other people that are part of my community engaged? So there's a lot going on in the next 4 weeks. I'm super excited. But yeah, those are just some of the things that I'm going to keep my ears to the ground on and try to share the news with folks who I know are a little bit more swamped than I am and that don't necessarily have the privilege to be as engaged as I am.
Well, speaking of engagement, do you want to tell where people can find this website we've been talking about, the CFS issues?
Please visit www.fairnessforstudents.ca, and it'll give you, like, a whole, but like, a summary of all the issues, some statistics. It allows you to take action by emailing the party leaders, because I know that the more emails they get, the more they pay attention to issues. But it also explains to you how you can vote, where you can vote, what you need to vote, because sometimes I know on the day of, you're like, oh, well, I don't have this, or I don't know if I can leave work, or I don't know if I can leave class to go vote. And we have rights, so let's act on them, and let's get out there and vote. In the federal, the 2015 federal election, we saw over 70,000 students go out to vote at advanced polling stations on campuses across the country. And that goes to show that it's not that students don't care, it's that we have to make it more accessible for students because of the unique realities that they have. So we're hoping that in the next few weeks, we're going to hear about on-campus polling stations, and we'll be sharing those, so stay tuned.
So, Noor, thank you so much for talking about the wide, varying, dizzying array of student issues, and thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
And once again, that was Noor El-Adib, the chairperson, president of the Canadian Federation of Students Ontario. You can learn more about the issues that CFS is promoting in this election by visiting their election website at fairnessforstudents.ca, and you can learn more about CFS at cfsontario.ca. And that's all for this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPN Classics and Sid Dale. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. The host for the Guelph Politicast is Podbean. Go to guelphpoliticast.podbean.com to listen to past episodes. And while you're there, you can also listen to Open Sources Guelph. If you missed last Thursday's episode on CFRU, you can download it via the Politicast channel on Podbean. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. There's also the Guelph Politico Facebook page at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you like locally sourced independent media in the city of Guelph, please consider donating to Guelph Politico on Patreon at patreon.com/guelphpolitico. For all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.blogspot.ca, where we will have a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you shortly. Until then, see you next time.